the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Walk with me. Thanks for joining me and downloading the latest Peter B. Collins Show. Be sure to share it with a friend. And speaking of friends, I want to thank listeners who support this program. Voluntary subscribers Tom McAfee, Janet Price, Mark Dennis, and Raymond Welch. If you're able and you'd like to, you can help. Go to peterbcollins.com. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. You're about to hear another installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, co-hosted with Sabelle Edmonds. And this is an eye-opener. We're going to talk with journalist Corey Pine, who started the website warisbusiness.com, covering contracting and war profiteering. And this is a resource I think you'll be happy to know about and will use as time goes on. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. I'm in San Francisco. Sabelle's in the Washington area. And we're joined today by Skype from London by reporter Corey Pine. His newest website is War as a Business, and he describes himself as a journalist who writes about money, politics, and violence. And prior to establishing himself in London, he's lived in New Mexico, Oregon, Georgia, Thailand, and other parts of Southeast Asia. Corey, welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you on the program today, and I want to start off by asking Sabelle, who discovered your website, to tell us what piqued her interest. And Sabelle, tell us why you were drawn to this new website, War is a Business.
Yes, Peter. As you know, I'm very picky when it comes to various organizations and websites and alternative media outlets that are popping up everywhere. I was, and I am, very impressed with this website for several reasons. And one of those is the fact that this website is going into the causes and talks about the causes and puts out facts about the causes, the diseases that we are facing, rather than simply symptoms that we are so used to see with, you know, most of these websites and the news sites, because they deal with all these different symptoms and various scandals that are, you know, popping up every day, so many of them. In fact, we feel kind of exhausted of reading about all these scandals, but none of them really want to scratch the surface, go deeper into these topics, and talk about, analyze, give facts about the contributing causes. And we don't have many of those causes. We have thousands of symptoms, but maybe a handful of causes. And this website deals with those causes, such as the lobby and the corruption, the military-industrial complex, war profiteering. And so that was one reason. And the second thing that I really appreciated about this website was its nonpartisan stance, because, as you know, and we have talked about it, we have had guests that I have confronted saying, well, I really smell a little bit of partisanship or too much of partisanship on this website. Well, this is not the case with warisbusiness.com. When you go to this website, you see that Democrats and Republicans are treated the same way. And some of the questions that I'm going to bring up and the quotes from the website is going to really, they're going to illustrate that. And also, the third reason, again, these are among many reasons, is the fact that the site really relies on facts, you know, thorough research and reports. So you really don't have to try to wade through it and see, okay, what is the factual element in this particular post or on this particular issue. It is not painted with so much, you know, sound bites and maybe biased opinion or flowery language. It just gives it to you. It says, look at this report, look at these numbers, look at the dollar numbers for this particular industry's contribution to various members of Congress. So you don't have to sit down and interpret it. It basically gives it to you factual, raw, and actually it makes sense. So these are the top three reasons I really like this website. I got hooked on it. I put it under my favorites, and I don't have many under my favorites.
I know.
You know, and our guests, many of them, they got to, you know, find out during our interviews. So I check it every morning, and I want to cover it on our website by giving it link. And it's, for me, so hard to choose because everything that is posted there is of interest to me, and I know that they are all of interest to all our readers and listeners.
Well, Corey, you just heard a satisfied user offer her perceptions of your site. How does that compare with your intentions, and is that valuable feedback for you?
Well, you know, that was a really fine introduction. Thanks, Sybil. You know, I think you hit on some of the things that were most important to me when I started the site. And I called it warisbusiness.com because I wanted to change the terms of the debate around military spending and conflict, and more importantly, to change the way that people think about power and how it's used in the world and why. You know, and that's contained in the very title, War is Business. The whole point is to get people thinking about the way these armed conflicts are going on in a new way, the sort of received way is that, you know, what, Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, we're protecting ourselves, when in fact a lot of these conflicts, not always in the origins of a conflict, but profit certainly helps explain why wars drag on for so long. So that gives you an idea of the general theme of the kind of stuff I'm writing about on War is Business.
So talk a little bit about the intersection of war and commerce from your point of view, Corey. Is this a recent development?
You know, it's not a recent development, and you know, I'm always at pains to point out that this is not an anti-war site. I very rarely will editorialize about whether I think the war in Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere is a good idea or a bad idea. It's an anti-war profiteering site. And in America, there's a long history of suspicion of war profiteers. You know, one of the most decorated generals in the U.S. military history, Smedley Butler, wrote a pamphlet in the 1930s called War is a Racket. And it was about him sort of repenting on in his time with the military, protecting commercial interests in imperial adventures overseas. So this is not a new thing. And after the 30s, certainly everybody knows President Eisenhower warning about the military-industrial complex in his farewell address. There's a long history of these things, but probably in the last decade or so, it's gotten worse, it being the influence of money and national security policy.
Now, the most obvious indication of that is the widespread use of private contractors, including armed security individuals that we would call mercenaries, to populate the military teams that we place in foreign theaters.
Yeah, that is the most obvious way that that's been going on. I believe in Afghanistan, private contractors outnumber uniformed American forces, international security forces. In Iraq, certainly, as the U.S. is de-escalating officially from there, they're also ramping up the number of mercenaries on the American payroll. So there's a lot of ways in which, you know, one of the biggest problems with privatized militaries are mercenaries allow governments to fight wars that they might have a harder time fighting otherwise.
Yeah, like with the draft.
Right. Like with the draft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if the only people who are fighting are people who are paid to fight, the risks are more narrowly shared and the rest of the people can go about their business as usual without having to think about the war too much. Obviously, in America, that wasn't the case in Vietnam. And the volunteer military is slowly devolving into the kind of mercenary military that, you know, was popular in the Middle Ages.
Well, and in the Revolutionary War, when the Hessians were fighting American Revolutionary Forces paid by the British.
Right. So this is a big danger of privatization, and it doesn't get talked about enough. Certainly, there's reporters doing good work about this issue. Jeremy Scahill at The Nation, Walter Pincus at The Washington Post. But it's certainly not at front and center of the debate, and that's one of the things I'm trying to change because, as Sibel pointed out, this is a root cause of many of the problems in our society and around the world.
And, Corey, like Sibel, it's hard to pick and choose among the stories on your site, and I want to recommend to our listeners that they visit warisbusiness.com and scroll down through some of your recent posts. Before we dive into some of the particulars, tell us a little bit about you and how you came to this work. Had you served in the military? Had you observed profiteering? Or did this come through your journalism?
It really came through my journalism. I'm a young reporter. I grew up in a pretty impoverished rural town in Washington State, and I never served in the military, but a lot of the people in my high school class, say, wound up there because there was no other real employment opportunity, and that's the case in many small towns across the country. So, you know, I'm not the type of personality that would do well in a military environment, frankly. I spent most of my journalistic career at alternative weekly papers. So, if I were if I were born a generation or two earlier, I probably would have been on the protester side of the Vietnam War as opposed to the serving side of the Vietnam War. That's kind of where I'm coming at it from personally. But, you know, as a reporter, I've worked all over the world, and in every job that I've had, whether at English language papers in Southeast Asia or at alternative weeklies in the U.S., I saw this private military business as a running thread in a lot of the corruption that I've covered. Massive amounts of money here in the U.S. going to really dubious security projects. One sticks out in my mind. When I was a reporter in Augusta, Georgia, there's a big U.S. military base there. It's also an NSA listening post. And it just so happens that the local city government there, I noticed a little contract that went out to a company that was like $3 million for fire hydrant protection technology. This company was going to go around and put backflow protection devices on all the fire hydrants in town so that terrorists couldn't roll up and dump poison into the water supply. And I thought, really? Out here in Augusta, Georgia? Is this a plausible threat? You know, is this a good use of money? Never mind the actual amount of poison that they'd have to pump into the water supply to have an effect.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of a classic example of war profiteering or Homeland Security profiteering in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I looked, the more I noticed. You know, I did it in my last full-time job in the U.S. in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there's a somewhat, well, people call it a cult. It's a Sikh, a Western Sikh sect. Most of its members are white, so they're, and they have some doctrinal differences from the Sikhs in like South Asia, and they have this group has a $500 million security business with the U.S. government, and given some of the doctrines that this group has and the fact that they've been labeled a cult, I thought it was kind of strange. But then you look at their political contributions. You know, they're big donors to the Democratic Party in New Mexico, and I thought, well, this probably explains why they're getting so much work. So you can look almost anywhere in the country and find instances of, you know, what would plainly be called bribery if it were happening in another country, or mm-hmm. corruption. But because it's America, we call it, you know, campaign contributions, and we're not so blunt about these problems.
Yeah. Corey, what I'd like to do is Sibel and I will alternate with references to stories that are on your site and use that as a kind of jumping off point for various topics. And let me start because you tagged this one item, a map, that shows 2,200 private U.S. military contractors. And you say, here's a rough version of a feature that you've had in mind for the site since you launched it last year. Give our listeners a description here of what you're trying to graphically depict with this Google map.
Yeah, the map is basically a map of the world. It shows, let me start with how I made it. I took a list of about 65,000 Pentagon contracts that were awarded last year and started narrowing it down to about 2,200, and these are contracts that were worth about $1 million or more, and I plotted them out on a Google map. So you can see that where the headquarters of various companies are located that are doing business with the Pentagon. The idea here is I really want to get readers of the site involved in figuring out where the private military companies are in their neck of the woods, because they are almost everywhere. And then hopefully to get people to help an ongoing research project that I have at the site, and that is to figure out the ownership of some of these companies. And even the Pentagon doesn't know who owns some of the companies with which it's doing millions of dollars worth of business a year.
And this distribution of the companies is by design, because when you spread the jobs and the wealth around to, say, hundreds of congressional districts, then you've got a natural lobby for continuation or expansion of these projects, even without corruption and graft. And now that I've said that, let's talk about the late Jack Murtha. He was a powerful Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania. Many liberals learned about him for the first time when he surfaced in opposing the continuation of our occupation of Iraq in about 2005. When people look deeper, you learn that in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which was Jack Murtha's home, there are, you know, literally tens of military contractors. And when you follow the money, you see that they lobby hard and they support the campaigns of the politicians who vote their way or earmark expenditures for them. And it's important to note that the former chief of staff of Jack Murtha is on his way to federal prison now. And he's got a long Italian name. I think it's Magliocati or something like that. PMG.
Magliocati.
Say it again?
Yeah, Magliocati.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I had a little trouble with that. Anyway, this is a microcosm of what Duke Cunningham did on the West Coast and what many members of Congress have built up over the years, where they earmark money that benefits contractors in their district, and then those people have the loyalty, the love and affection to return some of that money as campaign contributions to keep their powerful benefactors in office.
Well, right, and that is really as nonpartisan as it gets, right? I mean, it's clearly about money. And this is why I try to keep the site nonpartisan, is because there's so many members of the armed forces who should be upset about this, and I'll tell you why. Because the budget for soldiers has been stagnant all these years, but the budget for contractors keeps going up. And the reason for that is exactly what you described. Private businesses are getting a payday from their political allies, and there's basically no check on this system, you know, except for hopefully outside reporting. I mean, the executive branch is obviously involved in it as well. So Congress, you know, Congress is basically, I don't want to say controlled. I mean, there are very few people in Congress who have the independence from defense contractor money to be able to do anything about this.
Right. And you know, every election season, people run from one party to another thinking that the solution is going to be based on changing the party. And after every election, we end up in the same position or actually worse. And you had a great post on this titled Boeing Lockheed Retain Congressional Post. And you gave this great example here where U.S. elections were a win for the military-industrial complex, even though its favorite candidates didn't all keep their jobs. And one of those candidates was, you know, Missouri Democrat Skelton, who lost his re-election bid for the U.S. House of Representatives. And you list Skelton's top four contributors, and they are basically Lockheed Martin with $44,000, General Dynamics for $40,000, Boeing $23,000, Northrop Grumman $21,000. And then you point to California Republican Bob McKeon, who was going to become the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, and you ask the question very nicely and sarcastically, guess which industry McKeon's biggest backers came from. So it's a win-win, you're saying, and absolutely that's true. So if the elections and they are not the solution, then what is the real problem here? Shouldn't it be the fact that we have a very corrupt campaign financing system that puts us in the same position every election that we have for Congress, where they present us with two candidates, one from each party, and no matter who gets it, it's going to be a win situation for the military-industrial complex?
Oh, certainly. I mean, very few industries have learned how to game the system as well as the defense companies as well. You know, it seems like it's approaching a new level. In the last round of primaries, BAE Systems, which is British-based contractor, does most of it to the U.S. government. One of its key lobbyists in New Hampshire actually ran for office as a Republican and very nearly won the primary. And that I think is unusual. And that might be the next stage in this, where, you know, the companies do away with the middleman, just have their own people elected.
Well, the Supreme Court's working on that with corporate personhood and the Citizens United decision.
Right.
Go ahead, Sibel.
Yeah, I have one more on this because you had another post, and this is something that I didn't know because the mainstream media didn't really pick up on that, or they chose not to publish on that. You compared during the primaries for the last presidential elections, you compared the contributions to Hillary Clinton from the military-industrial complex versus John McCain, which was really amazing. In fact, if I'm correct, you actually said this was the largest donation to be received by the military-industrial complex by any candidates during the primaries?
Oh, geez, I'd have to look up that post. That must have been an earlier one. It's not jumping to mind.
Yeah, it was about 4 months ago, and I was shocked because most people would expect, you know, with John McCain's, military background, it would be a huge gap between him being ahead than Hillary Clinton, yet Hillary Clinton actually had more donations from contributions from the military-industrial complex than any other presidential candidates during the primaries, and you actually noted that, in fact, maybe it's because she had learned from her husband's mistake.
Well, you know, in the same vein, how many people who voted for Obama know that that the president, you know, a president who a lot of people, I think, thought was going to do something to at least slow down the wars we're engaged in overseas, is actually pushing the biggest arms deal in world history, a $1 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia. That is the Wall Street Journal has covered it. The New York Times has had a couple of stories. I don't know if that's been on cable in any great extent, and I think it's just not reaching the average American.
Well, and Obama also offered and then rescinded to Israel a sweetener to try to persuade them to extend the moratorium on settlement building near Jerusalem in exchange for some military hardware. So that has become quite common. Corey, go ahead and finish your thought.
Oh, yeah, that was a huge scandal. I mean, it was a $3 billion arms offer in exchange for a temporary halt on settlements.
Yeah.
I mean, it just shows that the U.S. has very little to trade overseas anymore except weapons, and that's just what's happened to our industrial base. So we can talk more about that later. Go ahead.
Now, Corey, I zoomed in on the map, and I just picked the state of Alaska because it stands out there, and it has 28 military contractors or private contractors. And I would suggest, without knowing, that this is the work of the late Ted Stevens, who headed the Appropriations Committee and delivered tankers of pork to Alaska, including almost getting his famous bridge to nowhere. Can you tell us any detail about what companies or industry subsets are in Alaska, and are there any interesting stories about how that developed?
You know, I'm not sure too much about Stephen's role, but, you know, there are... There is a provision in the procurement code, U.S. government procurement code, that allows certain special preference to be given to Alaska Native corporations.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at the Washington Post, I haven't done too much on this myself, so I don't want to spout off too much about it. But the Washington Post did a series recently that showed how this provision has been exploited by larger contractors. Basically, they use a Alaska Native shell company to land the contract and then give the tribe a cut, which is typically a very small portion of the proceeds, and keep the rest of the profits for themselves, essentially getting around competitive bidding rules. So I don't know how much of that is Stevens and how much of that is larger contractors exploiting the tribal preferences up there.
Corey, I have been fighting these whole secrecy issues in the United States, both personally, also lately in my blog site, and one of the most important or actually most covered cases recently has to do with all the WikiLeaks and the cables, the release of the 250,000 cables. And I checked your site, and you had a post on this, and I read this paragraph that you wrote, and I was really impressed because I agree with it, and I want to read a paragraph from what you wrote on WikiLeaks. While the classified U.S. diplomatic cables published by WikiLeaks do contain some important news, there is far more important information already in the public domain, particularly when it comes to the arms trade and war profiteering. This public information hides in plain sight, waiting to be pieced together and put in context so the average person can understand why they should care. The shortage of information is, at least right now in the United States, less consequential than the shortage of reporters who can make sense of it all. And I truly agree with this. And can you tell us a little bit more about what you're conveying here?
The WikiLeaks is kind of dangerous territory because, unfortunately, it's become a real polarizing issue. Either you stand for WikiLeaks and free speech, against in it with the Pentagon. I don't think it's that simple, even though it's been reduced to that. So I want to hedge my criticism of WikiLeaks, and that is, it's what WikiLeaks is doing. They say it's journalism, but it's really not, in the sense that they're not constructing a narrative for people to latch onto and understand. And that's really an essential part of the work of a journalist, is to take information, decide what's important from it, and arrange it in a way that makes sense. And WikiLeaks, you know, God bless them for finding all this, all these cables and inserting them into the public domain, even though they're sort of coming out at a trickle now. But that's a distinct process from the kind of journalism I'm trying to do. I'm really trying to basically create a framework so people can understand their world. And I feel like what WikiLeaks is doing is essentially taking a bunch of information, putting it out, and saying, okay, everybody, you figure it out. Well, most people don't have the time or the expertise to be able to do that effectively. So I guess I believe that there's still room for professional journalists in the world.
I agree with that, but here's one of the issues and problems that whistleblowers are facing. You know that the New York Times, they received the disclosure on the NSA's illegal wiretapping, and they sat on that story for over a year. And the AT&T whistleblower client went to LA Times, and they took the information from him, and actually they turned it over to Hayden and to the government, basically, instead of running the story, and they didn't publish the story until it came out. So when you have whistleblowers, especially from the national security arena, from CIA, FBI, DOJ, and I'm not talking about classified information that have informants' names or they are damaging. I'm talking about when the government classifies information, okay, because it's embarrassing, because it's covering up certain criminal activities or, you know, abuse of taxpayers' money. And these whistleblowers and these people who are like, you know, they're conscious, really bothered by these. They don't have a place to go because they go to L.A. Times, and the L.A. Times is going to turn it over to the government. And they go to New York Times, they hand it, you know, the documented information that is not damaging to the national security. And the New York Times, you know, decides not to run it for because they're close to the government or for whatever reason. I'm going to just... Then they feel like, okay, if you want to disclose information, and this is the sorry state of the mainstream media here, then what do you do? And that is the question. Because on WikiLeaks, I haven't been talking about it much myself, and I think the focus on what's going on has been, in most cases, wrongly placed. But what would be your advice as a journalist? Because this is the situation with the mainstream media, and the legitimate people, whistleblowers, who want to disclose information that is crucial for the public, because the people have the right to know. And again, I'm not talking about justifiably classified information. I'm talking about willy-nilly, capriciously classified information to just protect, you know, people from being prosecuted or whatever.
Well, I think you've identified a really important problem, and I hope that I have something close to a satisfying answer, but I'm not sure that I do. I'll say this. What you're describing is a real issue with the daily press, which is sort of been the last bulwark for free expression in America, at least what's left of it. And I would say to a whistleblower, make sure that you can trust who you're working with. And unfortunately, I don't think WikiLeaks is at the stage where you can trust them as a leaker. Never mind as a media institution. If you look through their procedures, you'll see that they rely quite a lot on an anonymous network of people who you're just supposed to believe have your best at heart. And I don't know, if I were a leaker, I'd go the underground parking garage route. You know, it was good enough for Deep Throat.
No, I hear you. I and it is a tough one. And you mentioned Walter Pinkston, Washington Post. I'm just going to go ahead and give two examples and get your take on this, just because it is relevant. You know, about a year ago, Politico exposed these salons ran by Washington Post. Basically, they almost acted like pimps, bringing the congressional people with the lobbyists for these dinners. And this is the Washington Post. I mean, we're looking at the national newspaper here. And so that said a lot about the credibility of Washington Post, or at least the management, the board of Washington Post, to a certain degree. And then you also look at some of these conflicts of interest that are floating out there. I mean, you mentioned Walter Pincus. And while Walter Pincus was covering Blackwater now XE issue, well, his son was one of the lead attorneys representing and defending Blackwater and getting paid. I mean, for me, it's like if I'm a journalist, I want to say no matter what, just because of even the appearance of it, I would want to stay away from this particular case. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I don't know if Walter Pincus disclosed that in anything he wrote about the company. It certainly would have been appropriate for him to do so.
He did.
That's the main thing. I mean, you know, I think that the culture of American journalism is slowly changing, so that those kind of disclosures are easier for reporters to make and keep their jobs, and that's probably a good thing. I mean, what you really don't want is for undisclosed conflicts. That's a lot more dangerous as far as people's credibility goes. So I guess I don't have a huge problem with Pincus's son's career, given his body of work. And I don't know Walter Pincus personally. I mean, I've spoken favorably of his work before, but is that what you're getting at? I mean,
I don't know if that conflict of interest or if it was the real conflict of interest, but it is eyebrow raising. And yes, he went on record and he actually mentioned that, yes, actually at the bottom of his article this. But then, as I said, it comes together with some of the other elements, and that is the case that was exposed with the salons that they ran, which was really segregating effect on Washington Post. And then, of course, the third thing that we witness a lot, we see a lot, is this incredible reliance on government official sources, you know, because when you get the major newspapers, and we have faced this a lot, and especially during this 5-6 years working as a National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, with more than 100 national security whistleblowers from CIA, FBI, NSA, is the double standards. For example, they get quotes and they get, leaks, and they disclose it as anonymous sources within the government, and they don't even ask for documentation or even second witnesses for, corroboration on that. On the other hand, when you have a whistleblower, the whistleblower is, subject to providing not only documents but at least two other witnesses who would corroborate this. So you're looking at these double standards, and based on experience, we saw what happened with Judith Miller, we saw what happened with David Rose and Vanity Fair article, the article he ran on Iraq on the scientists that later on was proven to be bogus, because he relied again on government sources, and because they are officials, they don't need to provide any documents or second or the third sources for the story. Yet if it's coming from a government whistleblower who is doing this, then they are basically demanding this criteria to be fulfilled. And to be fair, why not have it for both sides? Because we have had so many of these cases that have been given to the newspapers by the government that have been proven to be lies, totally false, and they never checked on that. And yet we have had whistleblowers such as Klein or the NSA whistleblowers who have gone and submitted information, and the newspaper, they choose not to run it.
Well, I can't speak for staff of newspapers everywhere, but the thing with a lot of these organizations is they're made up of people who Well, they tend to have a sort of pro-establishment worldview.
Right.
You know, and I made most of my career at alternative papers, and that was for a reason, is because you have a little more freedom to speak critically and skeptically of the system as it is. And that's a big reason why I started this website. I mean, you know, who covers the defense industry? I mean, the Washington Post does for sure, more so than the salons or anything else that they do there. They'd rely heavily on advertising revenue from the defense industry. Beyond that, there's trade publications, which rely exclusively on revenue from defense contractors like Lockheed Martin and Boeing. Can you trust those outlets to give you a critical perspective on that industry and how it works and how it interacts with politicians? I don't think you can. I think that's been proven that you cannot. So I hope that with Wars Business, I'm meeting a unmet need in the news ecosystem, as it were.
Certainly do.
And Corey, I have a couple of comments about WikiLeaks, and I want to just echo the comment that Sibel most recently made and kind of reframe it. Leaks are a way of life in our political system. And there are all kinds of official leaks that occur on a regular basis. At the height of the most recent WikiLeaks debate or scandal, whatever you want to call the imbroglio, we had two very important leaks of the identity of the top CIA officer in Pakistan, not from WikiLeaks, and the New York Times front-paged the story of the secret plan of the Obama administration to widen the war in Pakistan. Again, leaked from a highly placed and authoritative government official, motives so far unclear. And so to me, number one, I don't consider WikiLeaks to be an act of journalism. Neither was Dan Ellsberg's release of the Pentagon Papers. He gave them to journalists to do their work on. And what I see here is a wholesale failure to really take this information and our political leaders to investigate appropriately and sensitively where real secrets or real programs might be compromised, and really shine a light on the hypocrisy, the double talk, and the outright lies that are fed to us on a regular basis. So to me, while there are many issues to discuss about WikiLeaks, I see it as a net positive that, A, it keeps people honest, and, B, it's a way of trying to balance the official leaks that occur with some political motivation, not always easily identified.
Well, all right, and I don't think anybody can seriously argue that there's not enough classified information floating around in the government. There's clearly far too much, and so a lot of this ought to be exposed, certainly. Not to get too far afield, one of my concerns about the sort of open season on anything that people consider secret is if they'll publish any cables they come across. I mean, would they publish your email if somebody leaked it to them? I mean, there's so many questions about this new all transparency, all the time environment that I don't think people have fully got their heads around yet. But again, I don't want to get too far afield.
Well, and the other thing I'll mention is that it can be gamed because of the anonymity of people who leak to WikiLeaks and because of the way that Assange and the other, members, if you call it that, of this loosely organized entity. They could be duped. There could be information that is inserted in there that is intended to spin things in a certain way. And just in sifting through the massive amount of data that has been released, we can be spun by what the New York Times chooses to cover and what they choose to leave out. And so there are many pitfalls to this. My point really is that on a balanced evaluation, that this is a way of forcing our elected officials to tell us the truth a little more often.
Well, possibly. I mean, you know, there's a difference. and this hasn't been emphasized enough, there's a difference between something that is secret and something that is true, you know, and I don't think that's emphasized enough by WikiLeaks itself. You know, WikiLeaks loves to play up the value of the information that they have, and that's not always warranted. And you raised this point yourself about how it's possible to be gamed. Beyond that, there's a fundamental issue of verifying information, and just because it's some diplomat's opinion, for example, in the latest batch of cables, doesn't mean it's true. And that's something that journalists are there to do, is to verify. And, you know, there's something with War is Business that I'm trying to do that not only is WikiLeaks not doing, but traditional journalism isn't doing as well. And that is, as I said, identify the beneficial ownership of some of these defense contractors. Now, some of them are publicly traded companies, and anybody can see who the shareholders are. Others are not. Others are very secretive, privately held companies, and there's no other way to find out who's benefiting from the war than to actually go look up the registrations and the documents and see who owns them. And in the process of doing so, you turn up a lot of new conflicts of interest and a lot of new instances of corrupt political ties. And there's a lot there, as Sybil pointed out earlier, that is hiding in plain sight.
Right, and that brings me to this problem with attention span when it comes to public and also the media, and that is, like, there is this thirst for, okay, give us more scandals and give us more scandals, and the scandal pops up or the expose, and within, I mean, they exhaust it. You have this mania, this manic attention on it for, I would say, maximum a week or so. And then the next one pops up, and then people that just run, and they start chasing that particular story. So we don't have this lack of expose scandals here. Maybe we even have too many of these, because these issues, these cases are being treated as this very short-term, almost entertaining. And then we are moving to the next one, next one, next one. You know, with this Watergate expose, I mean, the issue went on for months and months, and the journalist, Washington Post, you know, it kept at it. And it was not like you grab a topic, you exhaust it to death in a very short period of time for 5 days or 7 days, and then you move to the next one, and then you just leave that previous scandal or case unresolved, unaddressed, you know, and the next one and the next one. And I don't know how much of this is a problem of the public and their attention span, and how much of it is the modus operandi by the media, because I know that people have become so much into combining entertainment and news together. And as is the case with entertainment, yeah, your attention is there. It's like, now give me the next scandal. You know, it was the case of 2,000 pictures involving torture. It was a massive, it was a huge deal. Then that went away. Then it was the NSA's illegal eavesdropping. That was entertaining for 2 weeks. All the blogs, everybody rushed towards the same topic. Then the next one, then the next one. And now, of course, we are seeing the same trend with WikiLeaks, but we don't see this investigative journalism when the topic keeps getting pounded upon and pounded upon until you start seeing some action, whether from the Congress or from the executive branch. No, it's not happening.
Yeah, and you know, you bring up an important question of why, and I'm not sure I know exactly where to place most of the blame. Certainly, I mean, people have known about these issues for years now, and whose fault is it that they're not taking action? It doesn't seem to me that you can blame the media as a whole, because within that there are people, you know, doing their best to bring, you know, important information out. But
Corey, next I want to turn to a special table that you have here called Top 150 War Corps. And this is the list of the military contractors who are getting the most out of the Pentagon. And let me just, for people's reference, in case they don't have time right now to go to the site, The top military contractor in this country is Lockheed Martin, $31.3 billion, and this is from fiscal year 2010. Boeing is second with $20 billion, 20.6. Northrop Grumman at 18.2. General Dynamics, 15.6. Raytheon, 15.3. United Technologies, 7. L3 Communications Holdings, $6.8 billion. BAE Systems at $6.7 billion. Oshkosh Truck Corporation, that's a surprise to me, at $6.3 billion, but I guess we got to buy those Humvees and MRAPs somewhere. KBR, a lot of people know about that, a former division of Halliburton at $4.6 billion. SAIC, $4.3 billion. And General Electric at $3.4 billion. You go on to list the entire top 150. And what do you see as the value of understanding who the top contractors are and how much they're getting?
Well, you know, the first thing that strikes you about that list, or at least what strikes me, is the sheer size of the numbers. I mean, it's really easy when you're listening to the news to just hear so 100 million on a new program, blah, blah, blah. But most people understand that $1 billion is a hell of a lot of money. And this, we're talking about tens of billions of dollars a year for one company. Now, that suggests that these companies have a massive, the numbers themselves hint at the influence these companies have over defense policy. The other question it begs is, well, what is the government not spending that money on? You know, and that's one of the things I wanted to put into people's minds with that list. The other thing is purely from an accountability point of view. What other areas of the government is so much money spent on private companies where you don't know what they're spending it on? You don't necessarily know who the executives are. You know, everybody knows Bill Gates' name, but who's in charge of Raytheon? You know, mm-hmm. Who's in charge of General Dynamics? The companies, people might have heard of them vaguely, but as far as the actual people, no idea.
Mm-hmm. And not all of these are American companies. Let me think here. Here's one. Kongsberg Gruppen ASA is pulling down $677 million in the current fiscal year. I've never heard of Kongsberg Gruppen ASA.
Yeah, me either. You know, there's a lot of foreign companies on that list for sure. Most of them are U.S. allies, but when you dig a little deeper, you start seeing that the idea of who is an ally and who is an adversary starts to blur when there's a lot of money involved. You know, I did a post recently spinning off of a New York Times report. The New York Times went and found all these special export licenses that the Treasury Department had granted to companies so that they could trade with countries that had sanctions against them, like Iran, North Korea, and so forth. And I went through that list and found 80-some major defense contractors who had these special licenses to be able to trade with, quote-unquote, the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows that, money is really the the currency of international relations here and war. The other example is there was a company called MENA Corp, very secretive company that came up in a recent congressional investigation. And,
right.
And Sybil, you're talking about things that should be scandals and be on people's minds. This story is definitely one of them. This company, MENA Corp, had been buying, it's the main fuel supplier for the U.S. war effort in Afghanistan, and the fuel it gets comes from Russia. You know, and that raises, there's a few middlemen along the way there, but, you know, it raises certain questions about the grand U.S. strategy here. The longer we stay in Afghanistan, the richer some Russian oligarchs get.
Mm-hmm.
Is that our big strategy? You know, you do have to follow the money to really understand the progress of these wars, the reasons for them, and likely the outcomes.
After the blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, many people wanted to see BP cut off of government contracts. They're listed here with a $516 million set of contracts from the Pentagon in the current year. And here's another curiosity, $500 million to the government of Canada. What exactly are we paying them for? I don't expect you to know right off the top, Corey, but the question is unavoidable there.
Yeah, I don't know right off the top, but I it's just, you know, the way some of these things are accounted for is a little bit mysterious. That could be some training agreement or, gosh, I don't know.
Maybe it's lease for the Dew Line. I don't even know if the Dew Line is still hooked up, but that's what they taught us back during the Cold War. We had the Distant Early Warning radar system deployed across the northern reaches of Canada. And I don't know if that's been replaced by some Star Wars gizmos or exactly what. Well, Corey, this is fascinating. And tell us a little bit about your extensive staff and the research crew that you have all over the world. How do you manage all this?
Well, you know, this is a startup, honestly, and I do most of the work. I do have a few contributors, some of them former colleagues, some people I met who are just interested in the work I've been doing, and I'm actually soliciting more. I set up a what I call a DIY investigations forum, do-it-yourself investigations, to try to make it easy for people who are interested in this subject come to the site, find a company that is curious to them, whether because it's in their neighborhood or they smell something fishy about it, and do some research to really contribute to this open body of knowledge. So at this stage, it's a kind of a shoestring operation, to be honest with you. And I do have some advisors. I'm proud to have an advisory board that includes some Pulitzer Prize winning journalists and other notable writers and thinkers. But really, I'm looking for money. I'm looking for contributors. And I'm looking for readers. So I hope your listeners do come by.
All right.
Hope you're going to.
And hopefully they can help you out on all three fronts. Well, Corey Pine, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for Skyping into Boiling Frogs today. And again, your website, warisbusiness.com. Thank you for joining us.
On us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.